1999, I went to Sadler's Wells and saw the photoplay screening of The Iron Mask. And it was my first experience of a live orchestra with a silent film. And I sat in the audience and I was so moved by the whole experience of being there. And then I saw Kevin and Carl Davis in the interval. And that was the first moment that I realised Kevin was behind all these wonderful documentaries. And Napoleon was restored by this person and championed by this person. That all the films I'd seen on television, all the Channel 4 silence, were restored by this person. And that was when I went to a second-hand film bookshop in Stroud and bought The Praise Gone By. And from there, I've just been hooked ever since.
A key moment for Chris Daniels, organiser of seasons of the popular Bristol Silence classic films, and an extract from Carl Davis's lush score for The Iron Mask. I'd admired The Parade's Gone By since its first publication in 1968, but only discovered recently that Kevin Brownlow had kept all the original interview tapes which made his book such an important and evocative chronicle of cinema history. So with the help of extracts from his unique photoplay sound archive, we discussed his remarkable one-man crusade on behalf of the lost art of the silent film. By the way, you must remember that he was still in his 20s when he recorded most of these interviews. At times, you can feel the amazement and delight some of the interviewees felt when they realised his astonishing depth of knowledge.
I'm sitting in a quite enchanting office, which is really a mixture between an archive and a cutting room. There's a picture of Buster Keaton on the opposite wall, various posters here and awards over the years, cans and cans of film with many classics like City Lights and some of Greta Garbo's most famous films, signed pictures by Lillian Gish, and two of those wonderful machines called Steenbecks, where you can view 35mm film if you want to, and an editing table. What a place. And I'm sitting here with Kevin Brownlow.
Could you tell us a bit about how you got interested in film so early?
The first school I went to, just after the war, every third Sunday, they showed films, and the headmaster couldn't afford sound films, so he bought in the silent films from Wallace Heaton Film Library. And so we saw Chaplin and Harold Lloyd and Snub Pollard. What struck me was the miracle of being able to convert a room into a cinema. So I went on and on at my parents, I must have a projector for Christmas. And then the next Christmas I got one. A Pathoscope 9.5mm Ace with a handle on the side of it and two films which I quickly ran through. And so decided to go out into the streets of London looking for more.
What sort of films were the first two?
The first one was The Naval Review at Spithead, 1935, and the other one was a Mickey Mouse. So I went out looking for more and went to Baker Street and found a photographic shop. And they had a pile of short films abridged, and they were 1/6 a reel. And so I bought the lot. And when I showed them, my parents, who were terrific film fans, immediately recognised who was in them. And so I was told, that's Douglas Fairbanks, that's William S. Hart, that's Bessie Love. And I was thrilled to bits by this. And I remember rushing to the library. In those days, you couldn't go to a library and find shelves of media studies. There was one book on film history called The History of the Film by Bardesh and Brasillach. And it fell open at a photograph from my Douglas Fairbanks film. And I thought, my God, if I've got a film which is in a book, this is really exciting. And so I suppose at that moment I became a film historian.
Silence were very early on your passion. How do you account for that?
When I got these early films for my projector, I found there was a freshness to the technique and a beauty to them which I was not seeing on the screen at my local Odeon. Films had become rather turgid. A lot of them were in the new CinemaScope, and people seemed to line up to say their dialogue, and they were literally talking pictures which did nothing but talk and simply registered the actors speaking. And the silence, because they were silent, had to work harder. they were more cinematic, and the best of them were stunningly good. And the more I found, the more exciting they got. The silent era, I've never exhausted it. You know, I've been collecting and watching these films for more than 50 years, much longer than the silent era lasted. And although there are plenty of bad films made then, as there are now, I've constantly been surprised at the range of technique, the brilliance of the people involved in it. It just gets better and better.
That love of silent films led to one of the essential books on the cinema. Until then, the pre-sound era hadn't been covered in any great detail.
I was in Hollywood in December 1964, and I'd been stood up by one of the Duncan sisters, and I was sitting in the lobby of the Maskers Club waiting and waiting for her, and she never turned up. And I was staring at the wall, and their past presidents' pictures were there. And an old woman was sitting there, and she said, "Who's that?" And I said, "That's Fred Niblo." She said, "Oh, Fred, you can't know that. You're too young." And I said, "Well, I'm very interested in silent film directors." She said, "Well, I'm married to one." So I said, "Who?" She said, "Oh, you wouldn't have heard of him. His name is Joseph Henneberry." I said, "Joseph Henneberry, Abraham Lincoln in The Birth of a Nation?"
Yes.
She said, "Yeah, you've heard of him? You want to meet him?" So she arranged a meeting, and it was one of those occasions where it's almost as if I asked one question and got a four-hour answer. I was changing tapes all the time.
Wonderful.
He was so full of information. And at that moment, when I saw him, I thought, I'm going to have to write that book.
I don't live in the past. I guess I do, but then I bet you the people in this street don't even know what business I was ever in, you know? Maybe next-door neighbors. Mike, to me, that's not important.
Who did His Majesty the American?
I did.
Well, that is one of the finest pictures.
You know what's the trouble with that picture? Well, all right. Now I'm going to give you a little lowdown on what you run into. At the time that the war was terminating, our President Wilson became involved in the League of Nations idea, and they had established the so-called 14 points. And they had prevailed upon Doug to make a feature picture with a 14-point propaganda. Now, if you want to find something that's tough to do and something you shouldn't do, get yourself involved in a picture that's supposed to be entertainment and at the same time has to do with propaganda. Well, we started to work on this picture finally, and we're no more than about two-thirds through the picture than the League of Nations already had fallen apart completely. And here we were with a picture that was based on things that were no longer existent. My feeling about that thing was always that it was a bunch of hash. I hated it.
You would be amazed. It's regarded now as one of the finest of Fairbanks pictures. It was recently shown in New York. Everybody flipped their lids over it. They thought it was superb. And it's very funny and a very exciting picture.
Can you understand how I must feel about it?
How could you fit in all those different trips and interviews in between doing your so-called proper job? How did you manage to do that? How long did it take?
The trip to Hollywood was as a result of one of my proper jobs. I'd made a feature film, and the producer paid for me to go on to Hollywood. And I did 28 interviews in 10 days. The book was a spare time activity, writing it in the evenings and at weekends. But it was so exhilarating, and these people were so fascinating. It struck me, it's rather like being a student of literature, and you find that Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway are still alive, but nobody's interviewing them. And I thought, this is crazy. There's so many of the silent veterans still alive. It's just a matter of getting to where they are.
And high on the list was Garbo's favourite director, Clarence Brown, a disciple of pioneer French director Maurice Tourneur, whose name Brown Americanized as Turner.
See, in those days, the cameraman and the director were the only ones that knew anything about the film. And they cut the picture, the cameraman and the director. And I watched them. I got in my head, I should be able to do that. And I wasn't with Turner a month till I was beginning to cut his pictures and write the titles. So it relieved him of that end of the business entirely.
Was he doing it himself before?
Himself and his cameraman. They had to look at the film to see what they had. I've seen Turning with 20 pieces of film hanging out of his mouth for this and this thing.
I received a catalogue from the Watso Film Library in Coventry, and the only interesting title on it was The Goose Woman. Now, that seemed to me a very unattractive title, but then it said, with Louise Dresser, Constance Bennett, Jack Pickford, and Gustav von Seifertitz. I thought, what an extraordinary cast. This is worth investigating. It's £12, and I can ill afford it, but I sent off The Goose Woman, and I remember when it arrived in its square cardboard boxes, the scent of camphor, which told me it was an original print from the camera negative, tinted and toned as it should have been originally. And I put the picture on the projector, and the razor sharp images were astonishing, but also the range of tint. The credits told me it was directed by somebody called Clarence Brown, and I made inquiries and discovered that he was still alive.
I remember a scene in The Goose Woman where Mark McDermott leans over Connie Bennett when she was an actress in her dressing room and to tempt her. He takes a string of pearls and drops it down in front of her on the dresser in front of her. And she picks up an orange stick and she never touches it, but she shapes the pearls on the table into an S. And she takes the orange stick and lays it on there and picks another one up and lays it on there. And turns up and looks at him.
That's exactly it.
Oh, we had fun making those. That to me was picture making in the silent days.
That was the beginning of a very important relationship in my life, because I think Clarence Brown is my great discovery. Each one of his silent films seems to be better than the last one, and I managed to find a great many of them, sometimes in unique prints. He went on to become Garbo's favourite director.
She got her comeuppance on Flesh and the Devil. That's the thing that...
Her comeuppance?
Well, it was the thing that made her famous. It made her...
Yes.
Garbo had something that nobody ever had on the screen. Nobody. I don't know whether she even knew she had it, but she did. And I can explain it in a few words. She was a very shy person. And not having a good command of the language, she was had a little bit of an inferiority complex. I would take a scene with Garbo. I never gave a direction to her above a whisper. Nobody on the set ever knew what I said to Garbo. And she liked that, because I didn't embarrass her in front of other people. I'd take a scene. I'd take it 3 or 4 times. I was never quite satisfied. When you saw that scene on the screen, it had something that the scene didn't have on the set. Now, that's a funny statement to make. But she had something behind the eyes that photographed that you couldn't see until you got up in a close-up. And you could see thought. If she had a look from here to here, where there was jealousy and there was love here, without changing the expression, you could see that in her eyes as she went from one side to the other. And nobody's ever had that on the screen. I don't give a damn who they were. For me, Garbo starts where they all leave off. Without the command of the English language.
Carl Davis's romantic theme for the garden scene from Flesh and the Devil.
Of course, Brown also directed another of the legends, Rudolph Valentino. How do his films stand up today?
I think Valentino is an extraordinary case because he became world famous with the poorest material. He made one masterpiece, which was The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, in which he is superb. And then he made, frankly, a lot of inferior films like The Sheik, which was made cynically for the women's magazine market, and in which he is instructed to act in an over-melodramatic fashion, and he was very ashamed of his performance. Mercifully, he's eventually rescued by Clarence Brown and put in a charming and very funny film called The Eagle.
How was Valentino to direct?
Wonderful.
And here's a quote you can take from me. I've had the opportunity and the pleasure and the good luck to have directed whom I think are the two greatest personalities that have ever been on the screen, Rudolph Valentino and Greta Garbo. And I say this to you and to anybody and to the world. You'll be hearing about Garbo, and you'll be hearing about Valentino, who's been dead 30 years now, practically, from now on, as you have in the past. And Gable hasn't been dead a year and a half, and all of the big stars, they've forgotten already. They are the two that are going down through posterity.
Now for a director who was active from 1911 to
1958. Well, I tried once to draw up a list of the pictures that I'd done. Somebody wanted them. There's a fellow out here, quite a historian. He's over in, I think, Wisconsin. His name is Wilkerson. And he knows all the details. So once he sent me a list of mine, he had on it well over 800 pictures and had only part of the list and was looking for some of the rest of them. So I started to try to help him find them, and I got to about 1,400 and some, and then I had to quit. I couldn't remember the rest.
Oh, Alan Dwan was... He was so entertaining that every time my filmmaking partner David Gill and I went to California, we always called on Alan Dwan to be stimulated, and he never let us down. Well into his 90s, he was still going strong. And very funny and absolutely the perfect silent film director.
So prolific, wasn't he, too?
Yes, incredibly prolific. And his star didn't survive the arrival of sound. He kept his head down and kept on making pictures. But some of the pictures he made in the silent days, like The Iron Mask and East Side, West Side, are great. And many of the others are extremely entertaining.
Alan Dwan was most famously associated with the swashbuckling Douglas Fairbanks, senior, of course.
That pillar where the stair wraps around, on the right of it was a big arch, and over the balcony. The balcony led off to another part of the castle, and the height of the top of the balcony to the floor was approximately 40 feet, which, of course, was a very high jump. And it was very vast. This thing's 450 feet long, just the interior of this room. Well, Fairbanks looked at it when he came back from New York. He'd been there with Mary, and he said, I'm not going to make it. And I said, why? He said, well, I can't compete with that. He said, my work is intimate. I can't work in a great vast thing like that. It's, what could I do in there? So I induced him to come back to the studio one morning, and I had a big grape hung from the ceiling, right sweeping down across that balcony to the ground. And I said, now, you get into a real sword fight with the knights, and they chase you up those stairs, battling all the way. And you fight them and fight them and fight them and succeed in getting away, and you run in through that arch and out onto the balcony. But as you do, some more knights come out of the door at the end of the balcony, and you're caught between them, and you haven't got a chance. They jump up on that rail, and you're fighting them, and then I stop talking. He says, yeah, then what do? And I jumped into this thing, and in the thing I had a slide, kids slide down, you know, and slid right down that curtain to the ground with a gesture like he used to make, and out through the arch to freedom. And he bought it like that. He says, I'll do it. He got up. He immediately sent out for some people, and he says, look, and he ran up there, explained it to them, and jumped in and slid down. He did it 1,000 times for people. They're like a kid, you know.
Douglas Fairbanks was the one who turned me on to silent films all by himself. His personality came out of the screen, and I was so smitten by Fairbanks, I went to see everything that he was in. I remember going to see Don Q, Son of Zorro, and being so exhilarated, I jumped all the way down the steps at Waterloo Underground Station, twisted my ankle. But he was an inspiration, as he must have been to so many people then, and he still is now, and I wish to heaven somebody would let us make a documentary about him, because he's so important, not just as an actor, but as a filmmaker, and a star who creatively controlled his films.
Another major star, who also had control of her films in those days, was Mary Pickford, who even stood up to the great D.W. Griffith.
Nobody directed me, not even Mr. Griffith.
Ah.
I walked out of the studio. I told him, I said, Mr. Griffith, I will not exaggerate. Do you know what he used to do, Kevin? What? He taught all of the ingenues the same thing, and if you see the films, Mae Marsh, Lillian Gish, ooh, little bird in the trees, ooh, little rabbit, I said, I won't do it.
I was invited to Pick Fair, and she wouldn't see me. And I wandered through the house, which was rather like a museum, and around the grounds, feeling very disappointed that she was at the other end of a telephone, but you couldn't meet her. I made a feature film which had been bought by United Artists, and in London, United Artists' office was run by a fellow called George Ornstein, who had married Mary Pickford's niece. And he said, oh, Mary's coming over, and she's heard that you've got a film with Jack Pickford, her brother, whom she loved. And so I was invited to meet Mary Pickford in order to show her The Goose Woman. And it was a very emotional experience, because she hadn't seen her brother on the screen, probably since he died. And he's extremely good in this picture. And she laid aside all embargoes on... Yeah, I remember her saying, I'll let you use your notebook, said I, switching on my tape recorder. And she was a combination of a fussy Aunt Susan and a very sophisticated, very funny woman.
I'm so pleased with you that I'm going to cooperate. And...
Oh, Margaret, that's very kind of you. Tremendous. Thank you.
You deserve it.
Thank you.
I wish you were my son.
I wish
nobody I were... follows in my footsteps today. None of them. My own children, none of them. And it's too bad, because they have a big heritage. They waste their time.
Throughout all these interviews, you can feel how Kevin gained the trust of his subjects by having done his homework meticulously. They gladly shared with him mementos from their movie lives, scrapbooks, informal photos, old stills, and publicity material.
All right, Kevin, go ahead.
He was George Cooper.
The Covered Wagon was a film that I revered. It was the first 16mm film I acquired, and I paid £2 a reel for it, and it turned out to be the most beautiful looking thing I had ever seen, and it was photographed by Carl Brown. So when the Museum of Modern Art rang up when I was in California and said, is Carl Brown still alive? I said, well, if he was, I'd know all about it, because I'd be so interested in him. Well, they asked somebody else, another historian who happened to have been in Army intelligence during the war, and he did the obvious thing. He looked him up in the phone book, and there was a Carl Brown, but he disappeared. And I was so humiliated, I thought I'd better find out what happened. And I followed a trail for 6 months before I tracked him down. And that night, my wife drove me in our little Volkswagen up Laurel Canyon through the mist. It was like going in, back in H.G. Wells's Time Machine. And we ended up in front of this little shack in North Hollywood. And I knocked on the door, and nobody answered. And I was walking away when I saw a picture on the wall moving. And I thought, that's odd. How can that be? And then credits came up backwards, and I realized I was seeing the reflection of a television set somebody was watching. So I knocked on the door, and a woman came to the door, and I said, is Mr. Carl Brown in? She said, how'd you find us?
Carla, how'd you find us?
Well, I tried everything you could think of, the post office, the social security, the people who knew everything, and I finally got the driving license people.
Oh, well, he's not very well. I'll see if he can see you just a minute.
Will you?
I'm crippled, excuse me.
Sure.
I went in, leaving my wife in the car, and Carl Brown was seated like a university lecturer, and he then delivered a lecture as though he'd been waiting all his life for this. And he was mesmerising. He'd been assistant cameraman on The Birth of a Nation and Intolerance. He worked with Griffiths from 1913. He'd been Arbuckle's cameraman. I mean, what a story. And he was quite happy to tell it, and later on I persuaded him to write it.
Griffith had a peculiar habit. He seemed to think it was wicked not to spend all of the money he had on his next production. Birth of a Nation made tremendous money for everybody who was connected with it, money and prestige. One of the most outstanding examples of the Midas-like touch of that particular picture is the case of Louis B. Mayer, who was a junk dealer in Boston. And he somehow wangled the New England distribution rights to The Birth of a Nation and made himself a fortune overnight. He just became tremendously wealthy on that one thing. He skyrocketed from junk man to the head of Metro.
Good. What do you remember about the making of it? It must have been an incredible experience.
It was just another picture. Really? Nobody ever knows when a thing is any good or not. I think that's the oldest paradox in dealing with show business. A fine actor, fine cast, fine playwright, an intelligent producer, the best director they can get, will combine to put on the finest possible. They have a generous angel, so they have plenty of money to put the thing on. No holds barred. So we're working on this thing, and once in a while some of us would stop and murmur, can he get away with that? And, well, apparently he could, and besides, it was his money. If he wanted it done that way, he was the one that was going to take the sock. But it was deliberately planned. He planned it for its riot effect. That's the reason that he opened it in Atlanta, hoping to God they tear the theater down. $1 million worth of publicity.
Oh, that was for Birth.
Birth of the Nation.
This is Patrick Stanbury, Kevin Brownlow's co-director at Photoplay Productions.
There's no getting away from the fact that the heroes of the second part of Birth of a Nation are the Ku Klux Klan. Nevertheless, it's probably the single most important film in American film history. But America wants to turn its back on the film, and we maybe rashly embraced it. As well as doing the documentary on Griffith, we were also commissioned to prepare a version of Birth of a Nation for television broadcast.
Louise Brooks enjoys a cult status today quite beyond the artistic merit of her Hollywood output. In fact, she rejected the studio system, and her enduring fame rests with her powerful portrayal of Lulu in Pandora's Box, directed by G.W. Pabst in Germany. Later in life, she became a perceptive writer about her contemporaries, few of whom ever equaled her abilities on the page.
Lots of people thought Thalberg was a fake, but of course he wasn't. Because he would do wonderful things with Norma Shearer. As you know, she had very bad legs. They were not only short, but they were bowed, and she insisted never having a double. So Irving would have to let her do all this, and then connive and intrigue in the cutting room. That they would cut and recut. One picture he cut was where she was in a girls' school and wore bloomers and marched. I noticed whenever there was a long shot, he would have her moving behind all kinds of furniture. So you just get a glimpse of the legs here and there, you see. So by the time Irving died, he knew so many ways to photograph her so she would never think that she was anything less than magnificent from top to bottom.
I was very intrigued when I visited the Eastman House at Rochester to know that she was living in the same town. And I went to see her and was completely smitten. She was in her late 50s, so she was, you know, relatively youthful with terrific energy, and she loved the era as much as I did, but she was much more cynical about it, and was like a very unusual university tutor taking me in hand and saying, "Oh, Kevin, you cannot have that attitude, you," and telling me stories from her own experience which had my hair standing on end. She had a most beautiful voice. It was a tragedy she didn't make it in talkies. She also had tremendous sense of storytelling and a great commitment to accuracy. And she would get very impatient if I accepted legends. And we began a correspondence which went on for, I think, about 200 letters from Lewis Brooks. Now, you have to say that was day one. Day two was the exact opposite. She had the night to consume at least one bottle of gin, probably several, and she was in a foul temper with a hangover the next morning. So it was very difficult getting through the next day. And that was what her correspondence was like. You'd get two or three magical letters, which you just couldn't believe, and then you would get one which was the sort of thing you'd get from a blackmailer or a your wife about to divorce you. But if you put up with that, it was a very rewarding relationship.
As I often say, I learned to act from watching Martha Graham dance, and I learned how to move in films from watching Chaplin doing imitations and clowning around one summer in 1925 when he was in New York for the opening of the Gold Rush. When he wasn't out with a lot of people, we'd all gather together in A.C. Blumenthal's suite in The Ambassador. And there, Charles was himself and perfectly happy, but he was doing imitations all the time. And one day he said to me, listen, Louise, guess whom I'm imitating? He walked away from me, wiggling his ass and twitching his shoulders, and it was the most, disgustingly silly effect it was. But of course I knew he turned around and my face was, I was only 18 and my face was grim and white. He rushed over to me and he said, oh, I didn't mean it, I wasn't really doing you, he said, but of course he was. And it took me years to get rid of that ridiculous walk that I cultivated very carefully in the Follies. I thought it was terrific until he did it. But that's when I discovered how powerful movement was and how if your movement's right, everything's going to be right after that. That's how Garbo acts. She knows what's going on and thinks about it, but she just puts it down to soak. But first she gets the emotion, and out of the emotion comes the movement, and out of the movement comes the dialogue. And she is so perfect at it, so marvelous at it, that people say she can't act. Because people must have some visible technique in order to judge acting, and there isn't any. Acting is a completely personal reaction. That is why I get inflamed when people tell me that Garbo can't act. She is so great. But they have nothing to get hold of, and critics, they have to talk about something.
Time you went to Pinewood with Gloria Swanson to see Chaplin. How did that all happen?
Gloria Swanson was the most difficult person, one of the most difficult people I ever had to get in touch with. She would not take a telephone call, and she just slammed the receiver down when I got through to her. But I found somebody who introduced me to her. Amazingly, we got on extremely well. And when she heard that Chaplin was making a film, she said, we've got to go down. And so she ordered the car, the limousine, and down we went and got held up at the entrance. And she says, do I have to do a Sunset Boulevard to get in? And when we got on the stage and Chaplin came to meet her, she reminded him that she'd played the secretary in his new job at SNA in 1915. And he fired her. And he said, I thought you'd be better in dramatic roles.
I can remember the morning that Chaplin was on the set, and there were all of us standing there watching him, of course, and he wanted somebody to do a little bit with him, and he chose me. And after about the 12th rehearsal of whacking me in the bottom, which I thought was most unfunny, and I was a rather tight-laced young lady, didn't think it was funny, had no sense of humor. Well, I still don't think that's too attractive, but anyway. He said I wouldn't do, and I was delighted. Oh, I was pleased, because I didn't want to have him kicking me in the derriere as I leant over to pick up my purse. It was in a doctor's office.
Do you recall who got the part?
No, I don't. No idea. If I saw the picture, it would be amusing to see the part I might have played.
In fact, it turned out that she did appear in the film after all. Although he's rated very highly today, Buster Keaton suffered from the autocratic behaviour of the studio heads when he signed away control of his own films.
Because of his career, I expected Buster Keaton to be the most bitter and difficult man be possible to meet. And when I talked to his agent says, I'll give you his number, but don't tell him I gave it to you. So I thought, uh-uh. And thinking that he was going to be a little old man murmuring into my microphone, I turned the volume up too high. And in fact, he had a tremendously strong voice. And when I made a documentary about Buster Keaton, my tape was the only one we couldn't use. Anyway, he turned out to be immensely entertaining because he was so fascinated by the technique of making comedy films and was only too happy to explain how they were done. And at the end, I remember feeling very sad I didn't have my movie camera with me because he got up and began to act out scenes. And I remember him asking his wife if she fed the chickens, and he began to imitate chickens waiting to be fed. It was hilarious. It would have been wonderful to have filmed him.
We always carried three men on our scenario staff. And by the time we decided on we were ready to start a picture. My head technical man that builds my sets, my head prop man, my head electrician, assistant director, everybody knows what we're talking about for weeks, so we never had anything on paper.
We never had a script.
Neither Chaplin, Lloyd, or myself, even when we got into feature-length pictures, never, ever had a script.
But what did Carl Harbour write then when he wrote your scenarios?
He didn't write nothing. He was one of the most useless men I ever had on the scenario department. He wasn't a good gag man, he wasn't a good title writer, he wasn't a good story constructionist.
But how come he's got several screen credit for Steamboat Bill?
Well, we had to put somebody's name up with Roland. And
you really had us historians on a screen, you know? You really
our
had.
Salary with us.
That's incredible.
Our scenario boys had to be story conscious. We couldn't tell any far-fetched stories. We couldn't do farce comedy, for instance. It would have been poison to us. So story construction became very important to us. For instance, somebody comes up with an idea and says, now here's a good start. We skipped the middle. We never paid any attention to the middle. Immediately went to the finish. We work on the finish, and if we get a finish that we're all satisfied with, then we'll go back and work on the middle.
People seem to always say Keaton is the greatest and put Chaplin down. How would you do this comparison, which is made so often it gets rather boring, but you've made documentaries on both. How would you compare them, really?
Well, I quote David Gill, who used to say, it would be like in the 18th century saying, oh, Haydn is so much better than Mozart, and you can't listen to Beethoven. It's ridiculous. We're deeply privileged to have had so many wonderful comedians, and they are incomparable. I would never have a program in which I mix the comedians up. They don't work together, but they are all absolutely magnificent. And if I want to convert people to silent films, I would just show them a Harold Lloyd. Then if I want to give people the finest possible experience, I would take them to City Lights, the Gold Rush, the Circus, the Kid. And then for the deepest pleasure possible, I just run the Keaton pictures. You just can't do better than that. But they're all absolutely magnificent.
Many people may recall Keaton's most famous comedy, The General, was set in the South during the American Civil War.
I went to the original location of Atlanta, Georgia, up to Chattanooga, and the scenery didn't look very good. It looked terrible. The railroad tracks I couldn't use at all because the Civil War trains were narrow gauge, and those railroad beds of that time were pretty crude. And you saw grass growing between the ties every place you saw the railroad darn near. I had to have narrow gauge railroads, so I went to Oregon. So
We'd got rolling equipment, wheels and trucks and stuff like that. We built our freight train and our passenger train and remodeled three locomotives. That's the general. And at that period, they didn't pay much attention to numbers of engines. They named them all. That's what accounts for that vessel of the general, and the one I chased it with was the Texas. The Texas I threw into the through the burning bridge.
In the case of Sidney Franklin, we got along so well, and my wife got along terribly well with him too, and we loved him.
Don't you dare use one word of this.
One thing I most regret is that I can't get a picture out of you that you could sign for me of yourself at 10-8.
Well, I can in time. Right away.
All right. What about those two little stills of Tiger Rose with Charles Roger? Can you spare those?
Uh-huh. I think so. Give me your name and address, will you? So I can look you up and have the FBI check you out.
He was very reluctant to talk because he was going to write his book. This was and still is a problem with Hollywood veterans. If they want to keep you at arm's length, they always say, I need all that material for my book, which they never write.
A seasoned Hollywood professional, Sidney Franklin became known as a sympathetic director of women, particularly Norma Talmadge, with whom he worked many times.
In those days, you had to use your imagination. If you wanted a boom shot, what you call now, that you have a magnificent mechanical instrument with eight men with earphones and touch buttons and everything goes this way and that way, we'd have to get a long telephone pole and put ropes on it and do all kinds of damn nonsense. And we pulled Norma Talmadge, or I did. She was a fairy. I don't know why she was a fairy in one scene. And it was a river, a good creek, I'd say twice the size of this room, up in Santa Barbara. And I wanted her to float in the air across this creek. And I put a harness on her and a piano wire on her back. And I risked this girl that was bringing in about $100,000 a week, I suppose, and floated her right across this raging creek with one little piano wire on her back. If it had ever broken, she'd have killed her.
What did she have to say about this?
Nothing. She did it. In those days, you didn't have doubles or you didn't have stunt men. Any star, they did what they were told. They were obedient in those days. You know, it isn't like today where the star tells the director what to do, you know, in most cases.
He invited us down to the desert where he lived in Palm Desert. And we had such a marvellous time. He began to open up. And then he decided I was going to write his autobiography for him. So he literally dictated it at weekends. And my wife went swimming in Malibu when they had moved to. And I just sat with him, fascinated. And occasionally we'd get stuck. And he said, oh, I expect I've got a file on that. And out the back in the garage, he'd rescued all his MGM files. And I remember looking through the file of Madame Curie and discovering memos in Scott Fitzgerald's handwriting.
Now, here's an old picture. You want to see an old picture? That's Norma Talmadge and myself and a friend in St. Moritz. That was silent days.
You certainly got some fantastic performances out of her.
Well, she was a grand actress. Easy to work with. Lovely girl.
And Regina O'Brien. And
this from a film that was photographed in San
Francisco? No, we were on a vacation. We were over there on a vacation, and we'd arrive in places, and there'd be as many as 10,000 people to greet her.
Who's there?
In the silent days, you know. It's not like that today. We had to have police escorts wherever, if they knew we were coming. On account of her, I mean.
I confess, I wanted to meet Boris Karloff, not to talk about his horror films, but to talk about the many silent films he'd made in Hollywood before that. And we spent a fascinating evening talking about those, and we're getting on famously until his wife decided he was getting tired and brought it to a conclusion, and I never had an opportunity of starting up the acquaintance again.
Boris Karloff, a.k.a. William Pratt, remembered the improvised nature of much of what went on in silent films.
Well, you'll find that was often true of films in the silent days, because they were motion pictures. The word motion spelled action, yeah. And they were rough and ready. You made up your lines as you went along to fit the situation. It didn't matter what you said, really, because there was no lip movement to match or anything of that sort, and you knew there was going to be a title in, and somebody would, in effect, write the story afterwards with the titles. George Marion Jr. was a great title writer, and you learned in silent films, if you had a piece of business that you particularly wanted to be left in the film, don't ever do it while your lips are moving, because that's when they used to cut the titles in. They would wait until you'd started to speak, and then cut, in would go the title. And if you had a special bit of business you wanted to get across, and it was done then, 9 times out of 10 it would be on the cutting room floor, because that's where they pop the title in.
I tried to be an independent director. I tried to be any sort of director, but nobody would put money up for the films I wanted to make. And I was asked to go to Thames Television to meet Jeremy Isaacs. By an extraordinary coincidence, he had used my book, The Parade's Gone By, as a farewell present to all the crew that worked on The World at War, which I thought was the finest thing I'd ever seen on television. And he thought there was a series in it, and he was a very remarkable and very brave producer.
I did not say I want to buy the book and have the right to. I said I want you to come to Thames and to make a series based on the interviews you have done for The Parade's Gone By, except that, of course, we will marry those interviews to the actual clips of the movies that these wonderful people are talking about. It was a very odd thing. He was bowled over at the notion, excited by it, and yet somehow still deeply distrustful of it. He didn't trust television to do anything like justice to the things that he loved. However, he was to come round, but meanwhile an extraordinary thing happened. He left my office on that day, walked out into the street, and collapsed in pain. He'd had some terrible, I think it was a peritonitis or something, dreadful. He was just struck down. So it was some weeks before he got back to me. But when he got back to me, he was quite keen. So we started, and the absolutely critical thing was that Kevin had done these interviews. All people were now getting old. We needed to interview them. We could interview them with Kevin's blessing and agreement, but we didn't have the rights to a single foot of the films we would need to use. And we could not get those rights for well over a year from the studios, which were absolutely, A, they didn't understand that they were sitting on something so wonderful. B, if they did understand that, they were determined that they would exploit it themselves. And so we had to make an act of faith, which I bless myself for, and say, never mind, we'll get those in the end. The important thing now is to go and do those interviews, to film the people whom Kevin had recorded on audio tape.
Carl Davis, who composed the music for The World at War, was invited to do the same for the new 13-part series Hollywood. Having immersed himself in the silent idiom, he was continuing a well-established tradition.
They did, with the major films, commission scores. How much they were used, I don't know. I mean, they may have been scores done for the premieres, and I think due to the fact that music publishers would probably never cooperate, they also, and this would be more or less for every film, would send out suggestions, a sheet sort of just outlining the scenes and what they would suggest. This was all possible to follow through the collections of mood music that were published at the time. And then looting from the classics is a favorite thing to do, and why not? The music's very good. And now, when we show these films, we're talking to a much more knowledgeable public. I mean, even today you can download anything off internet. So if you actually use a very popular piece of symphonic music, of classical music, the audience of the 20s and before then would not necessarily have many associations. It probably in the majority wouldn't even know what you were doing. But today, I think you have more of a responsibility towards the fact that, people know a lot more music. And so I'm very careful. Kevin's great stand is that if it is very familiar, it'll be distracting.
Do this program without talking about perhaps your grand passion, Abel Gance.
When I started collecting 9/5 films, I acquired one which was so bad I had to get rid of it. I couldn't have it in the house. And I rang up the library and they said the only thing we can offer in exchange is something called Napoleon Bonaparte and the French Revolution. So I thought, oh, that'll be another of those boring classroom films, just static engravings and text. And when it came through, I was ill at home, away from school, and I suddenly recovered when the parcel arrived and set the projector up. My parents were there, and I showed them these two reels, and they were the finest examples of cinema I had ever seen. It was pure cinema. It was the cinema that I always dreamt of seeing. And I was so impressed that I wrote a fan letter to the director again. No idea that he would get it. And I got an answer. And so that began a relationship. Unfortunately, my school French was dreadful. But somehow we made each other, because Gance didn't speak any English. And years later, I was able to begin the restoration of Napoleon, which only took 25 years, and I'm still working on it. But to me, the film is still the greatest film I've ever seen.
Thanks to the success of Hollywood, Thames were brave enough to commission Carl Davis to prepare a score for Napoleon. And when this was performed at the Empire Leicester Square in November 1980, a day that nobody who was there will ever forget, Jeremy was in the audience and decided that not only was Napoleon going to be screened on Channel 4, but there should be a whole series of classic silent films presented in an intelligent way for modern audiences with good orchestral scores. And that was really the birth of everything that we were to do. Not only would there be more documentaries following in the wake of Hollywood, but a whole series of silent features that would be restored, not only for television, but also, once done for television, they'd be available for live presentation.
I had to put together what I had learned and think of how to do this live, because this was a dead practice. There was no one I could turn to and say, well, how do you, A, compose a through score that's not going to stop? Because in silent film, except for the occasional dramatic pause, you've got to have music. I mean, that was the kind of basic principle of the silent film, both for filming and performance, is that silent film was never silent, which we never tire of saying, and that actually watching a silent film without music is a very dry and rather academic experience. Music, a couple of good quotes of Conrad Wilson in The Scotsman saying it really was like an opera without voices. Someone else said that it's very interesting because it's also a bridge across the decades.
Mary Pickford, quoted at the end of your book, said words to the effect it would have been more logical if silent pictures had grown out of the talkies.
Yes, I know exactly what she means, because the silent film, it's actually a misnomer. Silence sounds as though you're missing something. In fact, when you see a silent film, you don't miss the dialogue and you do not miss the effects. You supply all these. It's rather like watching ballet. You become a creative contributor to it in a way that you don't with a silent film, because everything's done for you. That's why I think people who remembered the silent film were so deeply in love with it. The motion picture people didn't think talk was necessary. The earlier experiments had been failures with talking pictures. So what they felt was silent film and music is the exciting medium. And then one of these films was being made called The Jazz Singer, and Al Jolson sat down and began to extemporize with dialogue. And people did love radio, and radio had been in for several years. And when they heard Jolson talking, that was perfection. It combined their love of radio with their love of movies, and their utopia had been achieved. Mammy.
Kevin's last word there somehow reminds me of a half-remembered line from a film in which a fugitive on the run is confronted by his pursuer. He says, "I'm a silent movie star, hiding out until the talkies blow over." I've treasured Kevin Brownlow's The Parade's Gone By for over 30 years now, and rereading it, I find his conclusion is as relevant as ever. One thing is certain, whatever future the cinema may have will be based solidly on its past. Time is a human conception, very much like a motion picture. It is all there, but we have to live it, and you cannot enjoy the last reel unless you know what happened in the first.